content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll start with an article titled Life Out of Balance by Sushma Subramanian. Nearly 2 million people have lost the simple ability to feel steady. Can an experimental medical implant restore it? For almost 4 years, Richard Stevens's brain felt as if it were jiggling around inside his skull. If he turned his head, his vision wobbled for a few seconds before it became steady again. To cope, he had to constantly pause to stabilize himself and make every movement deliberately to avoid getting a headache. Though he initially had to be in a wheelchair, he trained himself to walk around with a cane and even to keep working his job as an employee benefits counselor, though he had to be driven there. Stevens already knew what ailed him: bilateral vestibular loss. He no longer had function in the sensory machinery responsible for balance. The involuntary movement of his vision was a common symptom. The trouble had begun after a motor scooter accident. The hospital treated him with antibiotics, and as happens in rare cases, the medication damaged the hair cells in his inner ear that detected his body's motion. Simple tasks like eating popcorn during a movie were out of reach, and he was prone to falling. He lost tens of pounds of muscle, no longer able to do his fitness training. His condition was irreversible, so he was prepared to deal with it for the rest of his life. It was just mind over matter that you knew the sidewalk was not moving, and it was just your vision making it look like it was moving, he said. I just progressed to the point that I could do things, but it was with severe restrictions. Most people can't imagine losing their sense of balance completely. But simply walking around depends on the vestibular system. It sends messages to the brain that combine with other information, such as vision, touch, and an internal understanding of body position, called proprioception. The invisible nature of this system makes it hard to recognize. We take it for granted until it goes awry. While only about 1.8 million people worldwide have severe vestibular loss, partial loss is extremely common. Some 20% of people experience vertigo at some point, and falling is the number one cause of death from injury in the elderly because people lose their sense of balance as they age. I'd argue there's no area of medicine where there's a bigger discrepancy between the number of people who suffer from a problem and the number of providers who are trying to take care of those patients, says Jeffrey D. Sharon, director of the Balance and Fall Center at the University of California, San Francisco. In 2016, Stevens took friends' advice to reach out to hospitals that were researching potential cures. He emailed Charlie Della Santina, an inner ear specialist who is also an electrical engineer, a biomedical engineer, and a neurophysiologist, and director of the Johns Hopkins Vestibular Neuroengineering Lab. Della Santina called him half an hour later. "There is hope," Stevens remembers Della Santina telling him. Around this time, Della Santina had received FDA approval for a trial designed to test a new inner ear implant to restore balance. Stevens would be the very first person in the world to take one home with him to test out. Stevens felt like he had nothing to lose when he traveled from his home in Southlake, Texas, to Baltimore for his surgery. A vestibular implant is a device that measures motion using a sensor that's attached to the side of a patient's head with a magnet. It conveys information using a series of electrical impulses that get transmitted directly into the vestibular nerve through a device placed in the inner ear. bypassing the damaged ear cells. The system looks and functions much like a cochlear implant, which restores hearing. When Stevens went back 3 weeks later to have the implant activated, Della Santina warned him that it would take time to adjust it. But right there in the office, Stevens felt as though there was an electrical current firing through parts of his brain that controlled his sense of balance. He noticed that his eyes weren't darting around as usual, and he was stumbling less, though he still needed the security of his walking stick and his wife Susan next to him as they made the way to the car. "I turned to her and said, 'It's almost like it's normal,' he recalled. The couple spent the weekend in nearby Annapolis, where they walked along the Chesapeake Bay and ate crabs. Stevens folded up his walking stick to experiment without it, and when his wife reached for his hand, he told her he was okay. When they were in the car, he didn't have to close his eyes to keep his vision from bouncing around. While the shaky sensation didn't go away completely, the scene in front of him didn't appear to swing several feet as usual, just a few inches, which he could manage. On Sunday night, while the couple was sitting in bed, the hotel room suddenly looked to him like it had turned upside down. Disoriented, Stevens fell over onto his wife as she sat next to him trying to type on her computer. She told him it wasn't funny, but it was no joke. It looked to him as though the room was flipping back and forth, and he had to hold on to the comforter to keep himself from falling off the bed. When the movement stopped, he called Della Santina, who sympathetically reassured him that it would take some time for his brain to accept the new inputs, and they could talk about it at his appointment the next day. "Bear with it," Della Santina told him. "It's a learning curve." Because almost all creatures need to sense gravity, our ability to balance has ancient origins. Even plant roots know how to grow into the earth, while stems know to move up toward the light. That might be considered a rudimentary vestibular system. As soon as there were animals that could move, they needed to keep themselves stable and reflexively adjust their heads and eyeballs like a Steadicam. A jellyfish has mechanisms called hair cells that, when brushed up against beach sand, tell it where it's tilted in relation to gravity. A fish has a line of hair cells that help it turn into the flow of water and control its oxygen absorption. The vestibular system of reptiles and mammals relies on the movement of hair cells within the watery landscape of the inner ear organs. Two inner ear structures called otoliths sensors detect both head motion and the pull of gravity, while three structures called semicircular canals specialize in sensing quick head rotations, driving a reflex that keeps our eyes and vision steady and clear. Fundamentally, the system works by detecting the movement of fluid within. Your inner ear is just an internalized version of the ocean that you have learned through millennia of evolution to carry around with you, Della Santina says. Scientists have never seen the cells inside a living person's inner ear. The tiny system is embedded in the densest bone in the body, deep within the base of the skull. Accessing it would risk damaging it. "You know how Lincoln is on a penny?" says Konstantina M. Stankovic, an ear and skull-based surgeon at Stanford University, whose lab is developing methods to access those cells. The size of the human cochlea, the organ of hearing, in cross-section, is the size of Lincoln's upper face on a penny, and the total fluid volume in the entire human ear is the equivalent to 3 raindrops. Like the 3 legs of a stool, the vestibular system works along with our senses to touch and of touch and vision to keep us stable. There are fail-safes when any part of the system doesn't work. If we lose function in one ear, the other can mostly handle the job. Even if we lose most function in both ears, the brain can amplify whatever weak signals still come from the ears, combining them with vision and other senses to tell us which way is up and how we're moving through the world. But all of those fail-safes are slower and less reliable than the vestibular reflexes that normally keep the eyes, head, and body upright and steady. Evolutionarily, balance came before hearing. Only later did the same kinds of cells that allowed humans to sense gravitational pull adapt from sensing vibrations through the snail-shaped cochlea, our organ of hearing. But treatments for hearing loss preceded those for balance issues. The first cochlear implant was placed in 1961, while the first vestibular implant was tested in 2007 by a team at the University of Geneva in Switzerland and Maastricht University in the Netherlands. For the vestibular field, it's been a bit longer because we don't understand the functioning that well. It's an invisible sense, an automatic sense, says Angelica Perez-Fornos, a senior lecturer at Geneva University Neuro Center, which pioneered the vestibular implant. We have the success of cochlear implants to inspire us to move forward and say, okay, yes, we can maybe do something. The Geneva patients had hearing loss as well as vestibular malfunction. Scientists didn't want to risk damaging a patient's hearing by trying a vestibular implant on its own, but they wanted to test whether cochlear and vestibular implants could work in the same way. Initial tests showed that the system gave patients more controlled eye movements in the lab. Over time, the vestibular implant became more complex, with additional electrodes, though it still stimulates only the semicircular canals of the inner ear to steady a patient's gaze. By then, Della Santino was already at work on a device that was solely for vestibular loss and secure enough that a patient could wear it long term. To an onlooker, someone with a vestibular disorder can appear clumsy or awkward or drunk, which adds a level of embarrassment to what's already a serious physical impairment. In the TV series Arrested Development, a character played by Liza Minnelli made the condition into a running gag. It's not easy to explain a balance disorder to the average person, let alone to a doctor. The Geneva Research Group did one small study that found patients took an average of 3 years to receive a diagnosis after their first symptoms appeared. Many describe being misunderstood by their doctors, who sometimes hesitate to acknowledge a condition they can't treat. In recent years, research in the vestibular field has exploded, along with exciting developments on a vestibular implant. A whole other field of gene research could soon help patients with genetic hearing and vestibular problems, replacing the mutated gene with a healthy copy. Effective treatments, Perez-Fornos says, could also make doctors take these cases more seriously and diagnose patients faster because there's finally a clear reason to do so. Our understanding of the field also helps patients a lot because they're not ignored anymore, Perez-Fornos says. When I visited Della Santina's lab, he was getting ready to meet with a patient who would become an implantee the following day. Michelle Bernas, a woman in her 50s from Waterford, Michigan, lost her vestibular function slowly for reasons she still doesn't know. She simply became more unsteady over time and fell more often. Through testing, she learned that her balance function was nearly gone, but because she's been able to compensate using vision, other people have a hard time understanding her condition. I tell them I feel dizzy and off balance, that if I were to fall, I couldn't catch myself, that I'm not able to help myself once it starts, she told me. And you know, they really don't get it. People don't believe you, and that can be tough. As a former medical assistant, Bernice figured out fairly quickly that her vestibular system was malfunctioning. She worried, however, that Johns Hopkins would reject her as an implant recipient because she performed so well during her testing. She was relieved when she found out that she remained a candidate and would receive her implant the following day. Another trial participant named Michael LaFrambois, a maple syrup farmer from Orwell, Vermont, lost hearing in one ear in his 20s and the other in his 50s. Today, he is in his 60s, and he doesn't know the reason he lost balance. Initially, he suffered from debilitating nausea. And while his body eventually got over the discomfort, he could never manage to focus his eyes unless he was completely still. He said he went from doctor to doctor trying to figure out what was wrong with him before landing on an ear, nose, and throat specialist who suggested he get involved in medical trials for vestibular system treatment. He received his implant 4 years ago, and he said it improved his visual focus by about 50%. That's been enough for him to resume most of his daily tasks. I watched LaFrambois perform various timed exercises, standing on a balance beam, walking in a straight line on the floor, and practicing standing on one foot with varying levels of electric stimulation. When he took a break, I told him how hard it was to understand, as someone who's never had a vestibular issue, what the loss of balance would feel like, because he seemed to be doing quite well. "Let me show you," he said, looking at me steadily. "Look at my eyes when I turn off the prosthesis." He removed the magnets that connected the prosthesis to his head, and his eyes began shaking back and forth uncontrollably. "I'm back to where I started." Della Santina had said he would make time for me to go through balance testing too, so I could see what the patients experience. They were also in need of some control subjects who didn't come in with balance disorders. He mentioned something about a rotary chair. I asked LaFrambois what I should expect, and he warned me about it. "It's worse when your vestibular system is working," he said. "You know that you're spinning and you'll get sick, but without it working, you don't realize you're spinning. You just feel the breeze." Della Santina came in a few seconds later, telling me the team was ready for me, so I stepped out into the hall for them. The researchers had me subtract numbers while standing in awkward positions and walking on a line of tape on the floor. After getting the lab's first perfect score on my balance and gait test, I sat down in the chair. It was a large contraption that looked like an airplane pilot's seat. Once I was strapped into the harness, I had to maintain a straightforward gaze so that the researchers could measure my eye movements. Soon, I felt myself spinning, my eyes shifting back and forth, trying to make sense of what my body was doing. After a few moments, I got used to the sensation and stopped feeling the motion so much. When the chair stopped a minute later, I felt as though I was being jerked the opposite way. "I've seen that happen sometimes," said Evan Vesper, a PhD student in biomedical engineering. He compared my inner ear to a spinning coffee cup that stops abruptly. The fluid continues to spin for a while longer after the container is standing still. The feeling only started to go away after they spun me around in the other direction for a minute. A wave of nausea hit me once I stood up to walk again. It took a few minutes to dissipate. To be in balance is about much more than avoiding falls or walking in a straight line, I realized. It is to feel in alignment. It affirms us to ourselves. Before Della Santina went to medical school, he completed his PhD in bioengineering at the University of California, Berkeley, where he helped manufacture silicon electrodes to study hearing and balance. Once he became a doctor, he started helping patients with hearing and balance loss. The first cochlear implants were rudimentary, but feedback helped to improve them. Today, they help not only people with near-zero hearing, but also those with less severe hearing loss. Yet these patients need some time to adjust to them. The sounds they hear might seem electronic or robotic at first. It can be months before the brain learns how to take in this new input and interpret it in a useful way. When Stevens fell over in bed that first weekend, Della Santina suspected the same process was occurring in his balance system. "Your brain is thinking, what the heck is going on?" Della Santina reassured his patient. "It has to adapt to that and learn how to interpret these new inputs. We know that people get really good at that with repeated practice." Because Stevens had spent years coping by the time he got his implant, he knew what to do. He lay down to rest for the night, and the next morning, he sat in the back seat of the car and closed his eyes, or look sideways out the window. If he looked straight ahead, his entire field of vision would bounce every time the car went over a pothole or accelerated at a green light. At the clinic, Della Santina put Stevens through the usual set of tests. He applied different patterns of electrical impulses to the vestibular nerve and asked Stevens what he felt. A vestibular implant can't exactly replicate the complex patterns an organic vestibular nerve receives, each of which signals a particular direction, speed, and timing of head motion. But a technician can usually find a pattern that feels natural enough for the patient's brain to accept as a useful signal. After Stevens went home with his device, his improvement was steady. The main benefit for Stevens and the other patients who received the implant after him seems to be an improved ability to walk independently. None of the patients are using canes or walkers they came in with, Della Santina said. It's been 5 years since implantation, and the tremors in Stevens's eyes are becoming much rarer. He says he's returned to about 75% of his typical functionality. He was able to restore his driver's license. He even started resuming some of his strength training and running and is in better physical shape than most 60-somethings. His old cane is permanently hanging on the coat rack at his gym, where it's been for years. I think running is about as challenging a task as we could ask anyone to do, Della Santina says. Every time your heel hits the ground, everything you see is bouncing. He marvels that Stevens is now able to carry out this complex activity again, thanks to a device that sends signals to his inner ear. It's really amazing. Next, we'll move on to an article in the National Treasure section titled A Measure of Change by Ashley Braun. Scientist Charles Keeling's ingenious flask detects swings in the Earth's atmosphere. To unlock the secrets of the atmosphere, first, travel away from cities, forests, cars, and people to somewhere the air blows clean, say the top of a Hawaiian volcano. Bring two round glass flasks, volleyball size but with the air vacuumed out, wrapped in surgical tape for safety. Point the glass nozzle jutting from each toward the fresh air. Now hold your breath and walk at least 10 feet into the wind. Open the valve, let the air rush in, and well, after the hissing has stopped, close it back up. Then you can breathe once you've done all that, says Tim Luker, a scientist with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography. Now you have an air sample, and I'm still amazed that it works. Charles David Keeling established this method in the mid-1950s at the California Institute of Technology. Back then, scientists didn't know how much carbon dioxide naturally occurred in the atmosphere. Measurements varied widely. Keeling cracked how to measure it precisely. Then he took this endeavor to new heights, 11,000 feet above sea level. At a 1956 meeting with a research director at the U.S. Weather Bureau, a precursor to the National Weather Service, Keeling made an ambitious pitch. Continuously monitoring CO2 using a gas analyzer, a high-tech but as yet unproven tool for the job. The Bureau's new research station on Hawaii's Mauna Loa volcano, with its high altitude and barren landscape, would prove to be an ideal collection spot. Along with that continuous monitoring, scientists would also gather 5-liter air flask snapshots, sampled in pairs, at remote locations around the world, analyzing the results under controlled laboratory conditions. Nearly on the spot, Keeling was offered funding to build a CO2 program, taking it to Scripps in La Jolla, California. He began measurements in 1958. As months and years of data arrived, Keeling's rigorous work revealed two global phenomena. Earth's plants inhaling CO2 each summer and exhaling it each winter, and CO2 levels' unrelenting annual increase. The undulating graph marking the atmospheric CO2 concentration will become known as the Keeling Curve. On January 29, 1982, at the Mauna Loa Observatory, a NOAA employee first filled glass flask I-457 when atmospheric CO2 levels measured 341.28 parts per million. Analyzed at the Scripps lab, this sample also could now reveal CO2's fingerprints from sources like living things, fossil fuels, and volcanoes. In the early 1980s, Luker joined Keeling's lab in La Jolla. The researchers were grappling with major questions of global carbon math from ocean to the sky. Activities like burning fossil fuels and making cement release CO2. But only half of the carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere. Land-based plants in the ocean, to a limit, absorb the rest, determining those fractions and limits, the mathematical destination of fossil fuel CO2, was a contentious scientific question, complicated by the burning of the Amazon rainforest to clear land for farming. Essential to much of this work was understanding how and where the planet cycles one of its most widely distributed elements through the atmosphere, ocean, and land. Those answers hissed out of glass flasks like I-457, gathered at stations from near the North Pole to Mauna Loa, and from the tiny Christmas Island to the South Pole. In his later years, Charles Keeling reflected on the slow-footed public response to growing evidence of climate change. People, he wrote in 1988, should heed the rise in atmospheric CO2 concentration as serious unless proven to be benign. He died in 2005. On June 7, 2022, Flask I-547 took its own last breath on Mauna Loa before embarking on a different journey, one to the Smithsonian's National Museum of American History. Curator Kristen Frederick Frost remembers the flask arriving at the museum, perfectly cradled in its custom padding. She marveled at the box's design, made to ship fragile flasks all over the world. "One of my big regrets is not collecting the box. We had to send it back," she says. When the flask took in its last sample in 2022, atmospheric CO2 levels registered at 421.36 parts per million, a concentration that Luker calls unbelievable. When the instrument first began collecting samples in 1982, CO2 levels had been 80 parts per million lower. At that point, the fires, the droughts, the floods, the powerful hurricanes, that was all hypothetical, he says, and now we're living through it. With global CO2 continuing to rise faster than expected, the Scripps team is part of a monitoring effort trying to understand why. The Los Angeles Megacity Carmen Project, a collaboration between Scripps and other organizations, seeks to zero in on the localized sources and forms of pollution in Southern California cities to better address it. Flask samples still deduce sources, CO2's fingerprints. "It's almost like a crystal ball," this glass flask, Luker adds. "It's just stunning that such a simple invention could have such a profound effect." We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.